pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views, and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business, and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. And once again, I'd like to thank myself for that introduction. Listeners, Trevor is still abroad, so we're joined once again by the stand-in Iron Fist, Paul. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott. Happy to be here.
Pleased to hear it. And as we always do, especially when we've got new people involved, we will go with our... what am I going to call it? A disclaimer? Usual disclaimer that says that while Paul and myself did meet through the Secular Party of Australia, that does not mean that this is an official podcast of the Secular Party. It's a couple of blokes having a chat about the news. Mm. And this week, I'll kick it off. Paul, we pulled off an opinion piece from the Drum website as part of the ABC by what... would be described as a feriologist, a Reverend Dr. Michael Jensen, the rector of St. Mark's Anglican Church in Darling Point. He's also an author of My God, Is It Possible to Believe Anymore?
Yes, it's an interesting hypothetical question. I think you know my answer to that one, Scott, but Reverend Doctor always amuses me. I dare say it doesn't take that much to acquire the title of doctor these days, but reverend just, I don't know, it almost seems to mock the title doctor to me, because it's an academic doctor, it's not a medical doctor.
No, exactly.
And for one to be a reverend and at the same time claim some sort of academic credibility or, you know, scholastic credibility, it seems almost a contradiction in terms to me, but that's just my personal opinion, of course.
Well, there'd be a number of people that would agree with you.
Maybe so what does the good Reverend Doctor say to us on this one, Scott?
Well, the good Reverend Doctor has concluded that if you want your kids to be happy, try religion.
He does say that.
Now, that really annoyed me the first time I read it because I thought to myself, you know, what the hell is he talking about? But the doctor does go into... where is he? He expresses all sorts of views, including... while it is expressed suitably in a neutral way in government documents, the WHO report, as in the World Health Organization report of 2002 entitled Broadening the Horizon, Balancing Protection and Risk for Adolescents, found that having spiritual beliefs was a consistent protective factor across cultures against early sex, substance abuse and depression. Paul, yeah...
what is a protective factor against early sex? So, okay, at what age do we call it early, and at what age do we call it no longer early, but legitimate, natural, healthy exploration of sexuality by young people? He doesn't make that clear at all, does he?
No, not at all. I mean, like, he goes on there to talk about... he doesn't go on and talk about it, but what he... actually says is it's, against substance abuse and depression. You know, I find that somewhat bizarre. Not that I've ever had a substance abuse problem. I never have, listeners. But honestly, this thing against, you know, it prevents depression and that sort of stuff. Well, you know, it's no secret. I am a homosexual and I grew up in a church environment. Mm-hmm. And it was a little bit depressing when you actually have to deal with that sort of thing on your own and so on and so forth. Yeah. And I think the teachings of the religion actually didn't help in that particular circumstance.
You wouldn't have thought Christian teachings on that on those sorts of issues would have helped you too much, Scott.
No, probably not. But then again, I suppose Judaism and Islam...
But look, maybe it's not too late for you if what he says is true. you know, you might get some comfort from the concept that... you know, that you're a inherently faulty person.
And that, you know, that I can be saved from myself if
that's
I
right,
simply
yes.
give myself over to... But look, you know, I mean, he breaks it down in... He goes in and talks about in April 2015, the New South Wales Department of Education and Communities released its wellbeing framework for schools.
Hmm.
The document encourages schools to consider the well-being of their student holistically,
yes,
including fostering what it calls spiritual well-being.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, spiritual well-being means different things to different people.
Yeah,
I
would it have means thought... just about anything to anybody who cares to take the time to try and say what it means to them, because it's such a fuzzy concept all round. You know, I remember... I've heard commentators say that they basically avoid using the word spiritual at all because it's just so meaningless, so devoid of anything specific or concrete that it's rendered virtually useless. And I mean, it is a nice sounding word. You know, people say, you know, their cat, you know, gives them spirituality, or surfing, or going out in nature. I personally find, you know, I could relate to the concept of, you know, walking through a nice forest, or, you know, being in nature generally as being the closest thing that I would consider spiritual. But I'm also one of those people that basically just can't be bothered using the word because it's so vague and nebulous and devoid of substantial meaning, you know.
Well, I mean, I think the other part of it too is that when to be spiritual, if you're a member of the Islamic faith, means something entirely different to a member of the Christian
and
faith.
And that's a very pertinent point, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Because if the Reverend Doctor's right, we should be encouraging everybody to, you know, to buy in wholeheartedly to the dogma of their whatever religion they adhere to or were raised in.
Well, let's not go too far yet, of course, because we get down further when he talks about the benefits of being, you know, part of the mind control cult. Well, did I say that? Yes, I did. Yes.
Did you say that?
Yeah. Anyway, we get down to the point once he's been through when he's been through all the benefits of what it is to be a member of a religious faith. We get to this: none of this proves that the religious claims are true, of course, and they still bear the weight of scrutiny.
Yeah.
They bear the weight of that scrutiny. But if you want your kids and parents to be happy, and if you want to know hope and experience peace, then church, temple, synagogue, or mosque is the place to be. Well,
what is he getting at? Because that's such a contradictory paragraph. None of it proves religious claims are true, of course, and we should be still scrutinizing them. So what is he saying? That he's a critical thinker on one hand.
He's claiming to be.
But on the other hand, he's saying that really this is virtually the only way that you might know hope and experience peace.
Which I find bizarre, and you know, I mean, this. Well, for starters, you know, he doesn't, you know, hats off to him because he doesn't just say church is the only place to get this. He talks about it being, you know, either the temple, the mosque, or the synagogue.
Yes.
So at least he's opened his mind up to say, well, religion's full stop.
Yes.
But to suggest that, you know, if you want to find happiness and experience peace, that you've got to know. You know what the garbage in the Bible tells you is. I find that somewhat delusional.
We discussed this earlier before we started recording, but in one paragraph he says the word spiritual is the preferred term in these documents as a catch-all for whatever beliefs a person may have in a higher power or whatever. What does he mean by whatever?
Whatever, that could be anything. You could be an atheist that says
could be
you know,
anything. Yes. A do-it-yourself spirituality could have that effect. What is a do-it-yourself spirituality? But let's be real about this. And don't you love his selection of words? Let's be real about this. It is in the religions, basic ordinary religions. What are ordinary? That there are ready-made stories of meaning and purpose. Meaning and purpose, Scott. Now,
see, this is the
are we talking about the Old Testament stories of conquest, rape, pillage, murder, stoning people to death because they're not virgins, sending out your daughters to the mob outside rather than the male guests that they're baying for? Sending your daughters out, offering your daughters as a substitute for your male guests, and telling the baying mob they can do whatever they like to your daughters, Is that the sort of story he thinks will inspire our children and give them peace of mind?
Peace and comfort, yeah. I mean, they're the stories that first struck my mind when I started reading this.
It's I
wrote the next to that very line that says, you know, ready-made stories of meaning and purpose. That's why I wrote the word garbage. I've not seen a lot of anything in those stories that tells you anything except for the fact that you are broken, that you are damaged, there's nothing you can personally do to overcome this. You've got to, you know, you've got to give yourself over entirely to this God to him fix you.
And for someone who claims that this is an antidote to young people getting into drugs, he then writes, But to sink yourself into the richness of one of the great narratives, to learn to pray, to listen to the divine, and to experience that profound inner peace that religious people experience, is to find something bigger than yourself. It becomes something that addresses you, that confronts you and encloses you. He almost sounds delusional. He sounds like he's been taking the drugs that he wants our children to avoid. Doesn't he?
Well, I mean, religion's the ultimate drug, really. It's the opium of the people, as Marx once said.
Yes.
It's, yeah.
Look, I think Marx had a very specific meaning in mind when he said that. But
well, of course, yeah.
It is, in a sense, a kind of, what would you say?
It's sort of like a
hypnotic?
Hypnotic that's drug? One word, sure, because it's a... You do delude yourself into believing that something is real.
It dulls the critical faculties.
Well, you do start to think to yourself, well, this is just the way things are, rather than you don't actually look at the world and say, well, those skeletons that are in the National History Museum, they're not my ancestors. You just point blank refuse to look at that and so on and so forth. So I'm not impressed with his main argument, that's for sure, but... You know, he says, you know, if you want your kids to be happy, try religion. I would suggest that those kids that are happy in religion are probably, for want of a better term, we'll use that American term, shall we? They've drank the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
They have accepted that this is real.
Yeah.
And that their only way to be happy is to walk in the warm light of Jesus.
Yeah, and as we know, he also mentions that he doesn't really mind which religion it is. And he does mention churches, synagogues, temples, etc. So if he's really serious about that, and then he writes in one paragraph, religions instill hope for the future and create meaning in life. Now, is he really serious? Does he really think that some of the things in not only the Old Testament but the Islamic scriptures are a source of hope for the future?
Well, even if we just ignore the Islamic scriptures and just go purely with the Christian scriptures, I mean, I wouldn't describe any of those stories about the, what's the word I'm groping for, Paul, the apocalypse.
Oh, yeah, like Judgment Day.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't describe any of them as hopeful, you know. Unless, of course, you're looking forward to meeting God, I don't know.
And spending eternity... it's mind-boggling. You hear various conceptions of heaven, but it doesn't sound like a place that I'd find particularly interesting or stimulating.
No, who was that author that said heaven for the climate, but hell for the company? Yeah. But Dr. Jensen, look, thanks very much for your piece, but I'll pass. Thank you. Yeah. And,
it was a bit of a non-event all round, his piece, I'd say.
Well, I think that's one way of describing it, yeah.
So we're moving on now, are we, Scott, to the Hajj pilgrimage and the unfortunate. And we are genuinely, saddened by the deaths of so many people. You know, I'm sure, Scott, you'd agree with me, we take no pleasure in the death of innocent people, even if they are undertaking something that we consider fairly...
There were two events during the Hajj.
Superstitious, if I can put it that way.
Well, I think that's a fair way of describing it. Listeners, there were two events during the Hajj that resulted in deaths. There was the collapse of the crane onto a mosque, killing 109 people. And then there was the more recent stampede that killed 769 people. So in total, 878 have died.
Yeah.
A special thank you to Simon, who alerted us to this particular story. You were right. We had been all over it anyway, and we were planning on giving it a good run tonight. But thanks very much for sending us the link to the ABC. In particular, he sent us details. Hajj pilgrim deaths, many among the dead would have spent their life savings to attend, says a Muslim leader. The Hajj pilgrimage is a once-in-a-lifetime event for many Muslims, making this year's stampede fatalities all the more tragic, a senior member of Australia's Muslim community has said. Now, Paul, you seem to know more about this, so can you give me and the listeners a little bit of a Hajj 101? What's actually involved?
I honestly don't have a detailed knowledge of it, Scott, but I have from time to time, looked on the internet at various aspects. I knew a Saudi woman a couple of years ago who told me she'd actually been inside the Kaaba, which is the cubic-shaped structure at the centre of the Grand Mosque, the one that the pilgrims attempt to walk around seven times. Now, the number seven seems to figure prominently in various superstitious systems, and it's obviously a feature here. Not to mention throwing rocks at a stone wall, throwing stones, and they. it just strikes me as pre-Islamic, and it's curious how Muslim theologians are so adamant that Islam is a very pure religion and it's totally dedicated to the worship of the one true God, who is Allah, and of course Muhammad, his messenger. When it's fairly obvious to me. Now, I've studied a little bit of anthropology at university, and the little that I have read tells me that it just sounds so much like a pre-Islamic animist type superstitious ritual, where they, you know, they walk around things a certain number of times, they throw rocks at things that symbolically represent some entity that they are, you know, expected to hate and punish, or throw stones at, whatever. But look, the Kaaba is an interesting structure because it was allegedly built originally by the man that we know of as Abraham, which the Muslims refer to as Ibrahim. Now, if that's true, if it was really built by Abraham, then Abraham, his time on earth is variously dated at somewhere between 1800 and 2100 BC, okay? And Muhammad lived, when was it, 570 to 632, I think, if I have it right, AD. Now that's roughly 2,500 years gap between its original construction by Abraham. Abraham, of course, is the patriarch of the Jewish faith as well, or I should say Jewish superstition, religion, whatever. Now, Abraham, in my teachings at Sunday school as a child, I never heard anything about Abraham traveling that far south. I thought he basically ended up in what we know as Israel or thereabouts. But, you know, Mecca is quite a long way further south. Now, you know, the Muslims may be correct. Maybe Abraham did keep wandering further south, and he and his son Ishmael are alleged to have built the Kaaba. And interestingly, in one corner of the Kaaba is a black stone. And the pilgrims are apparently, one of their aims as they're walking around it is to get close enough to be able to touch or even kiss this black stone in one corner of the Kaaba. But interestingly, Scott, I mentioned to you earlier, I've looked at close-up photos of this thing in the corner of the Kaaba, and as I mentioned to you, there appears to be something silver metallic attached, and it looks very much like a human female vulva.
Is that right?
Yes, which I found totally intriguing. I mean, obviously, as I said, I've studied a little anthropology, and the female reproductive system and the vulva, in fact, is a fairly common element in ancient religious systems, and even Australian Aborigines. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to Carnarvon Gorge
in
central Queensland. If you ever get there, Scott, you'll see what I'm talking about. But there are some rock paintings in Carnarvon Gorge, Aboriginal rock paintings. I'm not sure exactly how old they are, but obviously, you know, they go back a bit. Now, there are some, and there are some, you know, officially erected explanations or commentary on the rock paintings. There are a number of vulvas, or what symbolically represent the human female vulva, painted on the rock walls in Carnarvon Gorge. So it would appear that the human vulva is a fairly common element in ancient I mean, obviously fertility is a common element in ancient religious beliefs, and it would appear that the ancient Arabs also had some sort of reverence for the
That's really interesting, though, vulva. Isn't it? Considering how some of the more modern interpretations of Islam are, well, they're downright bloody misogynistic, aren't they?
Many would say so.
But anyway, well, that was very interesting, and it goes on further. If we look into this original, and again, listeners, there will be links to all of this up on the website. But one thing that found me somewhat physically sick was there's a Mr. Patel from the Australian Federation of Islamic Councils, Iqbal, I believe I pronounced that right, Iqbal Patel. He said, "It is unfortunate for the families that somebody they love has passed away, but the ultimate is that if you have this unfortunate that you pass away in Mecca, then you go straight to heaven."
Yes.
Well,
in fact, Scott, Susan Carland, I think her name is, who is a sociologist at one of the universities in Melbourne and married to our friend
Waleed Ali.
Yes, Waleed Ali. She even mentioned that. She was asked on her about her views on this tragedy. And she basically, it sounded a bit flippant to me, I have to say, but maybe she wasn't, you know, trying to be too flippant, but she said, "Oh well, the upside is," and I'm paraphrasing, I'm not quoting directly. She basically said, "Well, the upside is, of course, that if you die on the Hajj, you go straight to heaven. So why would, devoted Muslims be too unhappy if their family members who died in that horrible crush, who were trampled to death, trampled underfoot by hundreds of humans, they go straight to heaven?" So perhaps that's the sort of... And I think she said, or somebody said, it's the silver lining in a dark cloud.
No, that's what...
Said, yes.
Patel had said. It said that was one silver lining.
Yes, it's an interesting concept. Well, so as I said to you earlier, Scott, I just wonder why the Saudi authorities who organise the Hajj aren't promoting that as an added benefit of going on the Hajj. You know? And they could, you know, I'm sure that it's not beyond their means to arrange it. Arrange it happening more often and more frequently.
Presumably that would violate one of the rules of Islam about not being able to commit suicide or deliberately murder someone or something.
You know, if you consider that everything that happens is God's will, I think you could find a justification for it if you really wanted to.
I suppose so. Anyway, this year the total death toll was 878. Mm. 1990, there was a massive stampede, and that killed 1,400 pilgrims.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in terms of that, the death toll's down on what it was in the...
It's a mind-boggling number, though, isn't it? 1,400 people dying by being walked over by many, many other hundreds of people behind you.
Mm.
And we were talking about this earlier, how when that mass of humanity starts moving, it's almost unstoppable.
Stoppable.
Well, it's stoppable by a brick wall, but it's not stoppable by
individual people
in front of them.
No, because the whole thing just seems to take on a life of its own. Mm. There's nothing you can do about it. But it's really awful. I mean, there's no doubt about
that. It's horrible. It's horrible. On the human level, on the real human level, it's a horrible incident.
And we go to the conversation. We're still on the topic of the Hajj, 2015. But the conversation, Ian Reeder, Professor of Japanese and Religious Studies at Lancaster University, Hajj 2015, the precarious balance between pilgrimage and consumerism. And this is a really interesting article.
Yes.
Listeners, it really is. It breaks it all down into looks into the business side of things.
Mm.
And one line that I have highlighted, because I found it quite interesting, these developments, along with the recent expansion of the mosque capacity that led to Crane tragedy, have enabled authorities to increase the pilgrim numbers and enhance the Hajj's contribution to the Saudi economy.
Yes.
One has to wonder whether or not that's the main reason for it now. Is it actually there just to...
Aren't you being a little bit too cynical, Scott? I mean, the Saudi authorities, you know, they place Mecca at the heart of their spiritual life, and you're suggesting that really they're being cynical about the whole thing, and just, you know, the well-connected families who own these big hotels all around the Grand Mosque are just cashing in. Is that what you suggest?
Well, that's precisely what I'm suggesting. Okay. Yes, yeah. I'm not backing away from that. No.
Mm.
Now, what goes into the rest of the article then from this is the very interesting when he starts to look at all the different pilgrimages around the world.
Yes.
And this is very interesting. This one that I only learnt of when I first read this yesterday was in Japan, called the, you know, if I get this wrong, Paul, you can hit me. Shikoku, is that how you say it?
Yes, Shikoku.
Shikoku is the emphasis on attracting visitors has led to downplaying of religious motives and the pilgrimage. Well, recent report, hang on a minute, oh yeah, has downplayed in the pilgrimage. Now, that I find bizarre. I mean, if it is actually supposed to be a religious pilgrimage, even if you've just got tourists coming through to have a look at it, wouldn't you still play up the fact that it was a religious pilgrimage to let people know why they were doing this? And then there's, of course, for those of us in the West, we've then also got the Catholic pilgrimage in southern France at Lourdes.
Yes.
Where Catholic authorities stated that more visitors to Lourdes could be considered tourists as opposed to pilgrims.
Yeah.
Now, that's a really interesting look at it all, because Lourdes, for example, the pilgrimage is rooted at the... is rooted in the supposed apparitions of the Virgin Mary in 1858. Yes. And in 1866, we had a railway connecting
several young
to
girls,
Paris.
I believe, wasn't it?
That I thought was in Portugal, wasn't it?
Oh, well, there you go. Who saw them in Lourdes?
Who saw
the Virgin Mary?
Bugger if I know, yeah.
No, I don't know either. That's something we should perhaps look into.
We probably should look into that before we went on board. But, you know, like I said, like the introduction says, we are about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Senate. But... anyway, it's a very interesting article because it tears it all apart and looks at the whole thing as a business rather than a religious pilgrimage. And to be honest, it's really hard to dispute what he has to say, really, isn't it?
Look, I can perhaps only comment on the Japanese case, having lived in Shikoku for a little over a year in recent years. Look, I have to say that it's predominantly tourists that visit the temples in Japan. There are a certain number of people, and if you go there, you will see people, ordinary Japanese people sometimes, and they do it quite seriously in some cases. They dress in certain sort of pilgrim clothes. You know, they buy one of those nice conical hats made of grass or straw or something. And some of them take it quite seriously, and they literally walk the entire journey, 900 miles.
900 miles, yeah, so it was 1,400 kilometres, yeah.
Yeah, around Shikoku. And on the other hand, most Japanese just like to visit because Japanese Buddhist temples, quite frankly, are very elegant, peaceful, aesthetically nice places to visit. And okay. You know me, Scott, and I'm not in the least bit religious, but when I'm in Japan, I do visit Buddhist temples because they're just such beautiful places.
Mm.
The architecture is elegant, beautiful, and they maintain them. The vast majority of the temples in Japan are well maintained, rebuilt on a more or less regular basis to maintain them, to keep them in good condition. And, you know, most of the ones I've seen are nothing like the Grand Mosque in Mecca with these high-rise hotels all around it. The ones in Japan are relatively low-key. There will be a few tourist hotels around them, but the fact is that they're all built... I mean, there are tourist hotels all over Japan anyway, and they're not just built for the pilgrims. You know, they're built for all manner of tourists, and the people who go on these pilgrimages just use the same tourist hotels as everybody else,
okay,
as far as I'm aware. It's just, you know, some Japanese people just consider it's a nice thing to undertake as a sort of personal... What would you say? Accomplishment. To be able to say, yeah, I walked it. You know, as I said to you earlier, many people will drive from temple to temple and just walk, you know, up the pathway or whatever it is that they have to travel over to reach the final destination.
Light their joystick and move on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Back now home. Mel Brough, who's the new Special Minister of State in the new Turnbull administration, he has made his first foray into the world of the Senate, and he's got his foot firmly shoved into his mouth. Mr. Brough has moved in to talk to the senators, particularly the Senate crossbenchers, about changing the voting system for election to the Senate.
Yeah.
Now, of course, everyone knows the name Ricky Muir. Ricky Muir is the Motoring Enthusiast Party who was elected to the Senate, and he only had half of 1%, I believe, was the final number of the primary vote. A very small percentage. However, it was the same percentage that Bob Brown received in Tasmania, meaning that he had even less numbers of actual people that voted for him than what Muir did, and we all know how that ended up.
Yes.
This has been talked about by principally the Coalition, but also agreed to by the Labor Party and the Greens, and also Nick Xenophon. Basically, what it was aimed to do was to stop the preference harvesting for minor parties and make it... Yes, it is harder to get elected then to the Senate, but it's also the idea is to stop that... what's his name? Drury, wasn't it? Was the preference whisperer that got Muir into the Senate?
Yes.
So it's basically killed his business, because what he did was he worked out arrangements between all the smaller minor parties and got them with the right preference flows to get themselves all elected into office. So that was what his argument was, that this is what they're going to try and do.
Ostensibly, it was about protecting democracy, wasn't it?
Well, that's what their argument is, yes. But, of course, you know... I have a problem with it, that when you get a result you don't like, you then say, well, what's the rules got to do with it? Should we change the rules? That's the cynic in me coming out there, is that this appears to be, by the government, an attempt to make sure that they don't have an unruly crossbench to have to deal with in the future.
And they've certainly had some difficulty in the last couple of years.
Well, of course they have, but they've also put forward some nonsense regulations too. And you know, Muir actually makes that point. Motoring enthusiast Ricky Muir said, "I would like to remind the new Special Minister of State, and indeed the Prime Minister, that although it can be difficult negotiating with diverse crossbench, sometimes we protect the government from themselves." You know, now, it's true that the crossbench has... halted things such as the university reform package, which would have resulted in completely deregulated fees being charged by university, and then the sky's the limit.
Yeah.
So, in that respect, I tend to agree with Senator Muir that the crossbench has saved the government and saved us an awful lot.
Yeah.
Paul, what's your view on this?
I must admit, I haven't studied the issue in great detail, Scott. In principle, I support democracy, and I think that whatever democratic system we have, it could probably always be better, and so we should probably from time to time be looking at ways to improve it. A couple of years ago, heard a lecture by the ex independent New South Wales state MP, what was his name, Mac?
Oh, Ted Mac, wasn't it?
Ted Mac. Mm. And he made what I thought was a fairly convincing argument for multi-member electorates.
Yeah, so it's basically to have the whole voting system would be very much like the Senate anyway.
Yes.
So
I certainly think that, you know, there may be areas that could be changed that would make the system more democratic and more representative of the will of the voting public. However, I'm not sure what those details might be or should be.
Mm. And look, you know, we'll have to see. We've still got to see where this is going to end up. But I'm a little bit concerned, I suppose, if that's the right word, for someone from either the Labor Party or the Liberal Party saying this is what we've got to do because it's the best thing for democracy.
The best thing for their democracy.
It's the best thing for them, yeah, because it restricts who else can get in there.
That's right. It reduces the competition to the two big blocks and the little minor block of the Greens.
Well, yeah, they, and they, you know, and then everyone else just, well, they get to chew what's been left behind by the big kids.
That's right. Perhaps they've sort of resigned themselves to, the Greens being there, or maybe they figure the Greens will eventually lose favour as the Democrats did.
Well,
and fade away.
We'll
and,
see.
And leave it to the two big blocks again.
Potentially, but let's hope that doesn't happen, because I mean, if they're just going to be deciding between themselves what the right thing to do is. But
some people are now arguing that the Labor Party is almost irrelevant anyway, and that they may be on the way out themselves. You know, they may be on a very, very serious path of decline, simply because they seem to have lost relevance for a lot of people, which is sad. I mean, they had a very respectable beginning as the party of the working classes.
Yeah, agree. Change of pace now. Back to The Guardian. The Guardian has an article there entitled "Artwork Showing Sylvanian Families Terrorised by ISIS Banned from a Free Speech Exhibition." This really grinds my gears, stuff like this, Paul. I mean, artists should be allowed to say whatever the bloody hell they want to and have it put on display. And if it's, provided it's not offensive or illegal or anything like that, the rest of us have just got to put up with it.
Yeah, I would go as far as to say that even if it is offensive, Scott, because there's no way of adjudicating what is or isn't offensive.
No, that's right. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you know, people can just take offence at the drop of a hat. It's,
In this particular case, Scott, the material in question was not so much, was not offensive in the way that perhaps something like Piss Christ, the famous Piss Christ, was offensive. It was basically composed of small toys, small toy animals dressed up and arranged in a kind of tableau outdoors, you know, little animals, various animals having picnics and enjoying life, being free and happy. And then being approached by these black-clad alternative little animals that were labelled mices. Now, it's an obvious reference to ISIS, but how is that offensive? Little toy animals dressed up in various scenarios. How is that offensive?
I don't think it's offensive at all.
It's toy animals, and yet the British police advised the people who were staging the art show to remove it, or they would be charged several tens of thousands of pounds extra for security.
Yeah, because £36,000 for security for the six-day show.
It beggars belief, doesn't it?
Well, it's, I mean, I let's cast aside what we think of actually turning our coppers into security guards for hire and that sort of stuff. And let's just look purely at the whole thing. Right. Listeners, there will be a link to this on the website, so you'll be able to see the picture that caused such angst. But Mimsy is the name that this person goes by. He's a London-based artist, was particularly outraged by the suggestion that this ISIS threat in Sylvania isn't real art. Now, this is not the only thing that's been put in this that's a little bit out there. There's an Iranian position, Iranian piece that is a life-size figure of a woman in a hijab decorated with chains and the naked torso of a woman about to be stoned for adultery by a Yemeni artist. What I find particularly disturbing about this is that we are self-censoring ourselves.
Yes.
Now, this is a British report, obviously. Mm. But having said that, though, it's not out of the realms of possibility that we would do something this crazy, too, that we would actually say, no, you can't have that. It might upset people and so on and so forth. Well, let's look, really drill down into this. Who are we actually afraid of upsetting? We're afraid of upsetting ISIS.
That's who we're afraid of.
Now, you know, there's probably a reason to be afraid of ISIS. But having said that, you know, should we worry about offending them? I would have thought that, if anything, we should be actively promoting offending them.
Yeah. Look, it's well known now that not only the British, but there are other countries in Europe, including France, unfortunately, where self-censorship seems to become the norm, where they seem so afraid of the potential violence that might be unleashed by, you know, admittedly a relatively small minority of the local population in those countries that might become violent and harm people. Now, of course, any government is duty-bound to protect its citizens from threats of violence. But at the same time, our Western liberal democracies are at least partly founded on the principle of intellectual freedom. And intellectual freedom absolutely demands freedom of expression without limit.
Mm.
Otherwise, there is no intellectual freedom.
The
exchange of ideas freely is the foundation of the development of our modern civilization.
Mm. But if I can just quote a couple of things that Mimsy actually said, I am aware of the very real threat to that freedom from Islamic fascism, and I'm not going to pander to them or justify it to like many people on the left are doing.
Mm.
And then we go down even further where she says, I'm sick and tired of people calling criticism of fanatical Islam racist, because racism is about your skin colour and radical Islam has nothing to do with that. Well, hello. You know, that's... Finally, someone said it, and yes. So congratulations.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Mimsy.
Look, people have, in fact, been saying this for a long time, and you know there have been, as you know, Scott, demonstrations in Australia, which, you know, I have to say, I think it's more than possible that some people in the demonstrations against the construction of synagogues may be, in some respects, what you might call racist. But you know, I wholeheartedly agree that this accusation that such demonstrations are evidence of racism is completely wrong-headed because, as you just said, Islam is not a race. And in fact, Muslims themselves, I'm sure, would tell you that Islam embraces all of humanity or potentially embraces all of humanity. So where is the racism?
Look, that's the main article. That's the main point of the article is that there is no racism in it to be critical of Islam, and the artist is not being critical of Islam full stop.
No, no.
The artist is being critical of the particular
aspects
of it,
of religious practice.
Yeah.
Now, some people would even argue that they aren't essentially Islamic practices anyway. But what we do know is that they are things that are practiced by communities which are predominantly adherents of the Islamic religion. So the connection is obvious, and we do make that connection, don't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're not allowed to... What it boils down to is we're not allowed to say anything critical about anything that people who profess Islamic religion do. We're not allowed to say that anything they do is bad, or if we do say it, we're only to say it in hushed tones behind closed doors, Scott.
Yeah, and that's not healthy for a democracy.
It's not healthy.
You know, a democracy is supposed to be open and transparent and so on and so forth. So, look, I'm very much supportive of the artist there. I think she's done exactly the right thing. You know, the artwork's probably not to my taste, but the point that she's trying to make is bang on the money.
Hmm.
Malcolm Turnbull, our new Prime Minister. We've got several articles there about Mr. Turnbull. The first
I have to give him full credit. He does have a nice smile, doesn't he? I mean, it's unfortunate, and I don't judge politicians by their physical appearance normally, but, you know, I have to say Tony Abbott, he always struggled to look natural and, you know, to have a warm, genuine smile.
He didn't really look comfortable.
He's not terribly photogenic, no. If we can put it that way, whereas Malcolm Turnbull... He's just, you know...
A nice bloke with a decent smile. Yeah.
He was born with the genes that gave him a good smile and a nice-looking, friendly, warm and cuddly face.
Absolutely. So we'll go through these relatively quickly, but the conversation, Turnbull takes coalition into lead in Trounce's shortening news poll. Oh, Trounce's, bloody hell.
Mm.
He went from being a fortnight ago, the government trailed the ALP 46-54 in the two-party preferred. The coalition now leads Labor 51-49. Mm. That's in a fortnight.
Which sounds close, but then when you look at the preferred leader statistics, it's a different story.
Completely different story. When you get down to the preferred Prime Minister, 55% prefer him to 21% of Mr. Shorten.
That's a big difference, Scott.
It's a huge difference. You know, and that is going to have caused all sorts of consternation in Labor ranks. Paul, they're going to be sitting there wondering to themselves, how do we extricate ourselves from this?
Yes, and of course they've made it much more difficult for themselves to remove a leader, haven't they, since the fiasco with Rudd and Gillard.
Absolutely.
They must be wringing their hands, Scott.
Well, I imagine they are going to be a little bit concerned about this. Then we're going to move on to the policy area. Brisbane Times, which is from the Fairfax stable, talks about the announcement last week, Thursday of last week, I think it was, about the boost to tackle domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what to say, Paul. I mean, I've never wanted to hit a woman. No, sorry, I've thought about hitting women before, but I would never do it. So I don't understand what to do to actually fix this problem. I know it's a problem. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not going to try and make out that I'm an expert because I'm just not. I don't know what the answer is. But I'm not convinced that education is going to fix it. Somehow we've got to look at the psyche of the male of the species. Yeah.
Look, I have to say I'm all in favour of educating kids to be nice to each other, regardless of their sex, their, you know, sexual orientation, gender, whatever. You know, I think violence is abhorrent and we should be doing, well, whatever we can within reason to minimise violence in our community, at a community level, at an individual level, at a family level, whatever. But I'm not convinced that there's a lot a government can do politically to address this, except that to put money into educating kids to be nice to each other. But I think, Scott, I don't know if you agree with this, but it seems to me it's an inherently almost a biological problem, isn't it? It seems to be a feature of the human male, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, throughout human history, men have certainly been a lot more violent than women, and certainly being physically stronger than women in general, the women usually come out second best.
Well, and that's just a sad fact of life.
It's a very sad thing.
Yeah.
And as civilized as we probably consider ourselves to be, it's still a factor of life. What can be done about it? I don't know. Does it? Is it a case of chemical control of people's violent urges? It's totally beyond me, Scott.
It's beyond me as to exactly what to do too. But the Commonwealth is putting $100 million into this problem. I don't know what they hope to achieve with it. You do have organisations such as Fair Agenda describe the announcement as a good start, but they're not enough. So
it may well be a case for the decriminalisation of marijuana, Scott, because you know, all the people I've known that were marijuana users, I've never ever seen any of them act violently after consuming marijuana. On the other hand, I've seen a lot of people under the influence of alcohol become extremely violent. So perhaps it's a case for the not only decriminalisation but the promotion of marijuana as a kind of sedative to calm everyone down.
Keep them all stoned, yeah. Maybe.
I mean, the worst thing I've ever seen happen to people under the influence of marijuana is they have an overdose of pizza or donuts or
something. Back onto the conversation. Grattan on Friday amid the warm glow. We don't know Malcolm Turnbull's program, and that's a very good point. It is a very good point because now where is it here? Did I actually mark it? In this article here, she does talk about how Turnbull won the election, not from the backbench. He was a senior minister. Yes, he didn't win an election. He won a party room ballot. So the whole thing's been designed in closed, behind closed doors and so on and so forth to get him into that position. There was no public argument for a case or anything else.
He didn't need a policy platform.
No.
All he needed was a change in the loyalty and the support of the party room.
Absolutely. Now,
it also made the point that he would appear to have given an undertaking to certain members of the cabinet, as it was, that he would not change too much radically the current policies of the party.
And that's become quite evident, you know, from the public pronouncements he's actually made on that.
So what do you make of that, Scott?
I think it was a necessity that he had to do it.
Do you think he will, in fact, make some significant changes, you know, in the fullness of time?
Down the track, it wouldn't surprise me, but he's going to have to shore up his numbers first. He's going to have to be certain.
He won't get rolled again.
Exactly. I suspect he's probably going to have to win the next election first before he's going to have to win
consolidate his position.
Exactly. He's going to have to win that fairly convincingly so that he can then tell them to get stuffed and get out of his way, so on and so forth. Of course, you know, that said, we're not going to see the, what's the word I'm groping for, Paul? The current climate change action, what do they call it? Direct action. We're not going to see direct action. Yeah. Direct action won't convert into a price on carbon just yet, but it is something that probably will happen after the election.
A lot of people suspect that he doesn't really support direct action.
No, I mean, he said so publicly enough on a number of occasions that putting a market-determined price on carbon was the cheapest way of dealing with the problem and so on and so forth.
It seems to be a more rational way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, me personally, I actually prefer a carbon tax as opposed to a floating carbon price and so on and so forth. I think they're far more honest when you call it what it is. But of course, all of that comes down to the fact that some of this easy public transition is because Tony Abbott, the former Prime Minister, and his administration had become so unpopular, and there was just relief on multiple fronts when the Turnbull coup happened. I mean, that's something that has really been underestimated in a lot of by a lot of commentators, is that, you know, Tony Abbott was just so incredibly unpopular.
I think Joe Hockey was part of the problem too. I think the two of them together
was disastrous.
Deeply unpopular.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And look at, I mean, Abbott appears to be hanging around, at least for the time being. Joe Hockey, he's cutting and running. He knows that it's all over for him.
Well, he's off to the United States now, apparently, to take over Kimberly Beazley's job. Is he?
Has that been announced?
It hasn't been announced yet, no, but it will be. We are just going to jump into something. Of course, it wouldn't be the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove if we didn't stick the boot into the Catholic Church now.
The Catholic Church again, Scott?
Oh, I know. Pope Francis was in the United States this last week, Paul.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of people turned out to see him.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredible, the crowds. There was this sort of rock star appearance whenever he turned up, the number of people that were there trying to get photos of him and so on and so forth.
It's astonishing, isn't it? How an old man who's a leader of an old superstitious cult attracts people like that.
Yeah, it's incredible to me too.
Did you see the photo that I saw on the internet of him riding in a so-called Popemobile? Now, I don't know how accurate it was, but the caption was, you know, three inches of bulletproof glass doesn't speak very loudly for faith in God's protection.
Well, I mean, yeah, if I understand it correctly, the Popemobile came about after John Paul was shot at. Yes, because before that, they just were out in open air, weren't they?
Yeah.
But anyway, Pope Francis is in the United States, and he had a private meeting with victims of child sexual abuse, and it's terrible, and they didn't know how to deal with it, and he's trying to do something about it now, but you know, is it too little, too late? Who knows? But he
does he really have? Of course, he's the leader of the Catholic Church, but I sometimes wonder whether he has the total respect, and indeed, do the bishops in every corner of the earth actually do what he asks them to do?
You'd hope they do, but apparently it wouldn't surprise me they don't. Well, we had that discussion last week on Catholic priests being moved from the United States into Southern America.
But even if he said, look, you know, we've got to crack down on this, we've got to turn people over to the police, we've got to not only be seen to be doing the right thing, but actually doing the right thing, do you think all the bishops who historically have been protecting pedophile priests would suddenly stop protecting their friends?
You know, I'm not sure they would.
These are people that they've spent their lives with, Scott. You know, they're just going to suddenly turn them over to the police?
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, I'm not sure they would, Paul, to be honest. I really would not be surprised in the slightest that they would just try and sweep it under the carpet themselves.
And continue to protect them.
Yeah, absolutely. But Pope Francis, he had this private meeting. He said that he vowed to hold responsible all those involved in the crime, all the cover-ups. Well, you know, we've heard it before. I hope he's genuine, but I'm not
sure.
Let's
hope he is, yes.
Now, one of the things that did prick my ears, of course, when I was looking through this, was the Pope told the gathering of bishops afterwards, God weeps. The Pope told the gathering of bishops afterward, the crimes and sins of sexual abuse of children must no longer be held a secret. Well, he's right. They shouldn't. They should never have been a secret in the first place. It comes back to all of that sort of stuff. Edward Snowden, the whole lot of them, the secrets of any organisation, whether it be a government or whether it be a large church or a company or anything else, secrets don't help anyone. It just makes life a lot worse.
They're bad for the health of society.
They are indeed. They really are.
They put people at risk because they allow these large organisations, whether they be governments, churches or whatever, to continue doing what they've been doing.
Yeah. And, you know,
with impunity almost.
Well, absolutely. And then when you consider what's actually happened here, I mean, like here we go, 1.2 billion members of the Roman Catholic Church. Well, 1.2 billion people have... if of that 1.2 billion, 1 billion of them are genuinely decent human beings, they've really been misrepresented by their organisation. It's been terrible. But, look, I mean, the Pope Francis, He spoke to the joint sitting of Congress in the United States, got a round of applause, so on and so forth. You know, it was...
I saw one view of that happening, and not everybody in the Congress was clapping.
Is that right?
Mm.
Yeah. That's what I saw.
Pardon me.
Yeah. But in keeping with the rules of trying to keep it to the hour mark, we're now at 58 minutes. So, Paul, what's your final observation for the week that was?
My final observation. We came across one article about the nanny state, Scott. I thought that was an interesting reference.
It is.
Because, you know, I'm not entirely clear, you know, where a nanny state begins or what it entails. I think it means different things to different people, doesn't it?
Well, let's hold that nanny state discussion over to next week.
Okay.
But we will actually bring that up next week then, ladies and gentlemen, because there is... Paul's dead right. It is a very interesting discussion. It's from The Australian, but we'll talk about that one next week as well. But to my way of thinking, this last week was... we were bedding down a new government. I think there's still an awful lot of warm in a glow about Malcolm Turnbull.
He's still on honeymoon with the electorate, isn't he?
He is. And, you know, We'll see whether or not that honeymoon lasts when he has to break people's hearts the first time, because I suspect he's going to have to.
Yeah. And are you of a sporting bent, Scott?
I am a bit of a sporting bent.
Are you backing either of the main football codes finals this
weekend? This final weekend, you know, I don't know anything about the domestic. Isn't that terrible?
Okay, so yeah. Broncos versus the North Queensland Cowboys. A total Queensland grand final in rugby league.
So you'd have to, well, from that point of view, you'd probably have to back the Broncos, but I don't know. What do you reckon?
I have a sentimental soft spot for the North Queensland Cowboys because I learned this evening from the TV news that this is 20 years, is it, since they entered the competition.
Is that right?
Yeah. And they've been in the final, I think, at least once before.
Okay.
So it would be kind of nice for them to win it, wouldn't it? You know, the North Queenslanders, I've spent a lot of time in North Queensland when I was young and love the place. It's one of my favourite parts of Australia, so I think my sentiments lie with the North Queensland Cowboys, Scott.
Fair enough. Well, we'll find out next week once the results
are AFL, I can't make a comment because I've never been a follower of AFL, but, you know, all the best to both teams.
Exactly. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for tuning in. And Paul, thank you very much for joining me again this week.
Thank you, Scott, for your invitation.
You're very welcome, and we'll chat again next week.
Look forward to it.
All the best. Bye now.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is, you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation, so you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners, and that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.